So we got to John 19. Maybe it's better, like, you know, this is the kind of text that everybody knows. I mean, if you've never read this, I don't even know what to say. Yeah. You know, because
never been.
And so I guess probably, though, you want to read the whole chapter first, then we'll talk about it, or you want to take it in chunks? I'm not sure what's best to do.
Pilate's move was to take Jesus with him and scourge. The soldiers then wove a crown of thorns and fixed it on his head, throwing around his shoulders a cloak of royal purple. Repeatedly, they came up to him and said, "Hail, King Jesus, hail, King of the Jews," slapping his face as they did so. Pilate went out a second time and said to the crowd, "Observe what I do. I am going to bring him out to you to make you realize that I find no cause against him." When Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple cloak, Pilate said to them, "Look at the man." As soon as the chief priests and the temple guards saw him, they shouted, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" Pilate said, "Take him and crucify him yourselves. I find no cause against him." "We have our law," the Jews responded, "and according to the law, he must die because he made himself God's son." Pilate heard this kind of talk. He was more afraid than
God. Okay, let's pause there. So here we have an interesting thing. So now Pilate is involved. Now Pilate's the governor. Obviously he's a pagan. He's not a Jew. He's a pagan. He hates Jerusalem. He hates the people there. The governors only went to Jerusalem on certain occasions. They were headquartered in Caesarea Maritima, which is a beautiful Mediterranean port. And it was a Roman city. And this is where Cornelius, where Acts 10 takes place, in Caesarea Maritima. And the Roman ruins are still there. It's a beautiful, beautiful place. But that's where the governors lived. And they went to Jerusalem for, like, certain occasions because they hated it there. And so Pilate's the governor, so he's the ultimate authority. But we know, like, Pilate keeps saying, you know, "I don't have a case against him. You know, I don't find any fault in him." But if you notice how weird it is, he punishes him before, you know, he punishes him first, which, of course, violates Roman law. It violates the Jewish law. Now, granted, Jesus isn't a Roman citizen. You know, when Paul's getting whipped, he says, "Hey, wait a minute, I'm a Roman citizen." And everybody goes, "Oh, wait, stop whipping him." Because, you know, a Roman citizen was not allowed to be punished unless they were tried. You know, they had to be convicted of a crime, couldn't be crucified. But there were, you know, other punishments. They could be whipped, and they could. And in Jewish law, of course, the law of Moses and the Torah, there had to be two or three witnesses. So whether you got Roman law or law of Moses, it's being violated here. Because here's a, quote, prisoner who really hasn't been charged with anything. Like Roman law, you had to charge somebody with a crime when you arrested them. You know, habeas corpus, and we have that in our law. So you don't just say, "Okay, you come with us," put you in a cell, and just leave you there. You have to make a charge. Say you're charged with, you know, robbing the store or killing the guy or whatever. So here, there's no charge of any kind, even the trumped up charges that are going to come later. But yet, he gets punished. He gets whipped. And even though he thinks maybe he's innocent, you know, he's trying to pacify the crowd. But of course, we know that this has to happen. We know that these leaders, the religious leaders, are the mechanism by which this happens. The Romans are the mechanism by which this happens. We know that he has to die. That's why he came. But this is just kind of the mechanism that gets rolling. But the Jews violated the law, too, by having the trial during the night. And they called all these weird witnesses and, you know, finally said, "Oh, he's a blasphemer," which they bring up here. But you know, Isaiah 52 and 53, the whole chapters, you know, that's the chapters of the suffering servant. You know, there's many Old Testament, there's many prophetic writings that talk about a suffering Messiah, and many Psalms that talk about a suffering Messiah. And of course, in the Torah is all about blood atonement, like we've been painstakingly through. And sometimes it gets pretty tedious, but it's about blood atonement. So all these things point to him, point to Messiah. There's a sense that Messiah is going to suffer. And they called him the suffering servant. In fact, like we probably talked about before, many scholars came up with the idea that there would be two messiahs. There would be a suffering messiah, Mashiach ben Yosef, Messiah son of Joseph, and then there would be Mashiach ben David, the Messiah son of David, a suffering messiah who they weren't quite sure what that was going to accomplish, why there was going to be a suffering messiah, but then a triumphant messiah, which is what they really wanted. Set up the kingdom like David and Solomon had. Get certainly at this point, you know, if you're the Messiah, you know, when do we start getting rid of these Romans and let's get rid of all these Gentiles and let's get the kingdom back. So they weren't quite ready for a Messiah who was going to die in such a horrible way, but they knew Isaiah 52 and 53. You know, you definitely should read that for your homework. Because it describes somebody being beaten, brutalized, killed, that wouldn't even look like a man anymore. Be so bruised and so swollen and so bloodied and wouldn't even look like a man. His appearance would be beyond a mortal man.
14. Even as many were amazed at him, so marred was his look beyond that of man. And his appearance beyond that of mortals. So shall he startle many nations. Because of him, kings shall stand speechless. For those who have not been told shall see. Those who have not heard shall ponder it. And 53:2 starts. There was in him no stately bearing to make us look at him, nor appearance that would attract us to him. He was spurned and avoided by men, a man of suffering, accustomed to infirmity, one of those from whom men hide their faces, spurned, and we held him in no esteem. Yet it was our infirmities that he bore, our sufferings that he endured. While we thought of him as stricken, as one smitten by God and afflicted, but he was pierced for our offenses, crushed for our sins. Upon him was the chastisement that makes us whole. By his stripes we were healed. Though he was harshly treated, he submitted and opened not his mouth. Like a lamb led to the slaughter, or a sheep before the shearers. Sorry. Someone else wanted to finish it. 7.
He was silent and opened not his mouth. Oppressed and condemned, he was taken away, and who would have thought any more of his destiny? When he was cut off from the land of the living and smitten for the sin of his people, a grave was assigned him among the wicked, and a burial place with evil doers.
Isn't that amazing?
Though he had done no wrong, nor spoken any falsehood. But the Lord was pleased to crush him in infirmity. If he gives his life as an offering for sin, he shall see his descendants in a long life, and the will of the Lord shall be accomplished through him. Because of his affliction, he shall see the light in fullness of days. Through his suffering, my servant shall justify many, and their guilt he shall bear. Therefore, I will give him his portion among the great, and he shall divide the spoils with the mighty, because he surrendered himself to death and was counted among the wicked. He shall take away the sins of many and win pardon for their offenses.
it.
Yeah.
The part where they say that the Lord was pleased, I mean, God the Father,
mm-hmm.
the Lord was pleased.
Yes. Yes.
Because it's a
prophet.
Yes. In Isaiah 56, I gave my back to those who beat me.
Yes.
My cheeks to those who plucked my beard. My face I did not shield from buffets and spitting.
Yes. Psalm 129:3, see if somebody can find. But see, there's so 129:3, but there's so much in, now Psalms aren't considered prophetic, but there's a lot of prophecy in them. David was, in fact, a prophet. A lot of messianic Psalms. The Psalms are lumped into the writing. They're the K part of Tanakh. But lots of prophecy. And the prophecies are suffering, suffering, suffering. We're going to get into some more of it later. But, you know, your heart melting like wax, tongue cleaving to your palate. Because of course,
Psalm 129:3. Upon my back the plowers plowed,
yeah.
as they traced their long furrows. But the just Lord set me free for the ropes of the yoke of the wicked.
Wow.
May they be scattered in disgrace, all who hate Zion. May they be like grass on the rooftops withered in early growth,
yeah.
never to fill the reaper's hands, nor the hands of the binder's sheaves, with none passing by to call out, the blessing of the Lord be upon me. We bless you in the name of the Lord.
Yeah, so furrows on the back. I mean, now, this kind of scourging, this kind of punishment, you know, when David's writing this, when Isaiah's writing this, you know, it's David's 1,000 years before Jesus, Isaiah 700 years before Jesus, and he's describing this brutalized man that you can't even recognize anymore. It goes on to add, and this is the key. This is why Isaiah is sometimes called the gospel according to Isaiah, because, you know, he says, our iniquities are on him. He's crushed for us. You know, he's got an infirmity because of us. We're healed by his stripes. You know, he's got furrows in his back, David writes, and we're healed by that. So all this was spelled out, what this was going to happen. This is why Isaiah 52, 53 is never read in the synagogues to this day. Because of that. It's the only portion of the prophets that's never read in the synagogues. And your Jewish friends will admit that that's true. I mean, the ones that know anything, they'll admit that that's true. Because they say, well, we can't understand. They always say, well, we can't understand what that means. We think it might mean Israel, but we can't understand it. And that's why I always used to say, well, I can explain it to you if you'd like. No, it's not what you think. And I'd say, well, if this person represents Israel, how are my infirmities healed by Israel's suffering? He said, no, it's just for Israel, it's not for Gentiles. I said, well, how can I be saved then as a Gentile? Well, you have to keep all the law. The second reading, which is called the Haftarah, that's the only part that's never mentioned. So so it talks about the punishment that we deserve. He gets the punishment, but we're healed by it. Now, when you think about it, you know, like, you know how Paul, in 1 Corinthians, Paul talks about, you know, the gospel's the cross is foolishness to those that are perishing. You know, we come with a foolish message. You know, we have foolish preaching. When you think about it, it does sound foolish. Mm-hmm. Like, how can our salvation depend on, you know, a man who was executed 2,000 years ago? Mm-hmm. Doesn't make any sense. You know, 2,000 years ago, they brutalized some guy and whipped him and nailed him to a cross, and somehow that has something to do with me? I mean, logically, that doesn't make any sense. It's all in the prophets. It's all in the Psalms. And then you see the soldiers abuse him, and none of the authorities step in. You know, their officers don't stop them. Pilate doesn't stop them. And you've probably seen, you know, we've had the guy who does the Man in the Shroud presentation quite a few times. I think Jim came a couple of times. But I don't know if we're going to have him this year or not, but if that's Jesus in the Shroud of Turin, he has almost 200 lash marks on his body. I forgot what it is, but it's almost 200. Now, The Jews only could hit 39 times. It's supposed to be 40 lashes, but they did 39 in case you lost count. The Romans didn't have that kind of restriction. We want you to whip this Jewish guy. Okay, let's bring him over here. You know, what did they care? So, you know, these soldiers just totally brutalize him. And as that passage in Isaiah says, he doesn't complain, he doesn't say anything. He submits to it because that's why he came. But nobody tries to stop him. And then, of course, they mock him with the purple thing and the crown. And, I mean, they just had fun with this. And the gospel passage, you know, compared to, say, the Passion of the Christ or other things that we know how they're portrayed, doesn't really give a full example of what the scourging was. Mm-hmm. It's pretty bad because, you know, they had pieces of metal and glass and shells and stuff in the whips. So it's pretty bad. And then, you know, he does it without resistance. He does it without complaint. I mean, he could have said, the next guy who hits me is going to be vaporized. Or he could have vaporized the whole lot of them. But he submits. And then, you know, Pilate says, I don't find any fault. You know, the Greek there means not even the slightest fault. There's not even like a slight fault in this guy that I can tell. But he's already kind of condemned him, had him beaten, all this stuff. I mean, I don't know. Like, you're in pretty good shape compared to me. I don't know how long, you know, you could take a beating like that. For us, we'd probably last about 10 minutes, maybe.
It was slow.
Yeah, and then after that, he's got to stand there. He's got to carry the cross. He's got to go all that way. And he's a 33-year-old man who is probably in pretty good physical condition. Did you ever go to the church in Ann Arbor, the Catholic Church, Christ the King?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if you noticed in the crucifix, but it's a very muscular Jesus. I mean, he's like got well-developed muscles. And, you know, the first time I went there, I said, wow, that's kind of interesting. And one of the guys there said, well, you know, 33-year-old guy, walked hundreds of miles at a time, worked. He would have been a muscular man. He wouldn't have been a little wussy man like we are. But even so, you take a beating like that. I mean, just imagine the fluid loss and the blood loss. I mean, you'd be fluid depleted within 5 minutes. Pilate says there's not even the slightest fault in this guy. Then he brings him out and says, behold the man, ecce homo. Because he figured once they saw this mess, they would say, oh, wow, you know, we shouldn't have done this. But no. Then they yell, crucify him. Okay, go on from there. Let's say start at verse 6. Oh, you read that, right?
Yeah.
Now read it again. That's all right. 6 through 8.
A little bit,
as soon as the chief priests and the temple guards saw him, they shouted, crucify him, crucify him. Pilate said, take him and crucify him yourselves. I find no cause against him. We have our law, the Jews responded, and according to that law, he must die, because he made himself God's son. When Pilate heard this kind of talk, he was more afraid than ever.
Yeah. So they invoke the blasphemy laws. Now, you know, in Torah, when you blaspheme, you're supposed to be killed. You tear your clothes, you kill the guy. But the second reason is he had to fit the pattern of Joseph in the Old Testament. So when they wanted to get rid of Joseph, we better not kill him. He's our brother. Let's have the Gentiles get rid of him. We don't want to kill this guy, but we'll have the Gentiles do it. You know, it's a parallel. So they claimed, well, we don't have the power to put somebody to death, so y'all have to do it. But it's, you know, weak. It was flimsy. Technically, the Romans did that. So they cite when they say about, he said he's God's son, now Pilate gets a little worried. Takes him in the praetorium. Now remember, there's a public place out in a open area, and then there's an inner chamber. So he takes him in the inner chamber. Now, remember, he's been whipped, brutalized, crown of thorns, you know. those thorns are like this long. You know, you have somebody in this condition, and then, you know, the judge says, oh, man, I need to talk to you. You know, let's go in my chambers. And, you know, it would be like us taking a prisoner and beating him half to death and then say, oh, the judge wants to talk to you in his chambers.
Yeah. After the interrogation.
Yeah, exactly. So now, you know, he gets scared. You know, going back to the praetorium, he says, where do you come from? Now, all of a sudden, it's like, maybe I better ask this guy some questions.
Yeah.
God's son, you know, what does that mean? Go ahead, somebody start reading from 10.
So Pilate said to Jesus, aren't you going to answer me? Don't you know that I have the authority to free you or crucify you? Jesus answered Pilate, you wouldn't have any authority over me if I hadn't been given to you from above. That's why the man who handed me over to you is guilty of a greater sin.
Okay, pause there. So now he gets even more scared. He says, hey, you better talk to me because I got the power to kill you or I got the power to let you go. And when he hears Jesus say, you wouldn't have any power over me at all if it wasn't given to you from above, he gets even more worried. So, you know, who has the power to do what? You know, technically, Pilate has the power. He could have said, okay, I'm letting you go. You're pardoned. And if anybody touches him, they're going to be arrested. Could have done that. But he chose not to do that, even though he was worried. Look what happens next at verse 12.
When Pilate heard what Jesus said, he wanted to free him. But the Jews shouted, if you free this man, you're not a friend of the emperor. Anyone who shouted, if you free this man, you're not a friend of the emperor.
Okay, pause there. So now they try a political approach. So if you free him, you're no friend of Caesar's, because if somebody makes himself a king, they're in opposition to the emperor. So you're going to get in trouble, dude. You can't be like letting people go who think they're a king. So now he wants to let him go more than ever, but then now they put the political pressure on him. And so he gives in. Now, in order for the Roman soldiers did the crucifixion, so Pilate would have had to give them an order, give them permission to do it, or give them some kind of warrant, or, you know, they couldn't have just said, oh, we'll take care of this, don't worry. So he must have ordered them, well, just go ahead and do what they say to cause the trouble. But see, he tries to wash his hands of it. Read the start at 13.
When Pilate heard what they said, he took Jesus outside and sat on the judge's seat in a place called Stone Pavement. In Hebrew, it is called Gabbatha. The time was about 6 o'clock in the morning on the Friday of the Passover festival. Pilate said to the Jews, look, here's your king. Then the Jews shouted, kill him, kill him, crucify him. Pilate asked them, should I crucify your king? The chief priest responded, the emperor is the only king we have. Then Pilate handed Jesus over to them.
Okay.
Mine says noon.
It says what?
Mine says noon.
Yeah, there's different translations. You know, it depends how you count the hours.
My note says...
This one says noon.
Either not.
All we know is it's Friday morning. It's noon at the latest. It's sometime between 9 and noon. By noon, it's generally accepted that at noon he was already on the cross and died at 3.
Yeah.
So, like, 9 is more likely, because to go from there to the crucifixion site, especially in his condition, would have taken a little while. But, and the crowds in the way and everything else. But regardless, it's Friday morning, and Pilate tries again, but then he gives in and says, he hands him over to be crucified. So he agreed to it. They didn't rush in and take him. He agreed to it. those soldiers couldn't have done it without an order from their superior. And so the whole thing just kind of goes, you know, Pilate even says, you know, that in the other Gospels it talks about this, you know, are you a king? You know, oh, you say I'm a king. Oh, then you are a king. So here he just says, should I crucify your king? So we have no king but Caesar. Pilate's basically cooked. He can't do anything more. And then he also doesn't want to have a riot on his hands. Because when, and they hint at this, you know, in The Chosen here and there, but Roman officials, you know, if word got back to Rome that they couldn't control their population, that wasn't good for their career. So, you know, if word got back to Rome that there were riots in Jerusalem and Pilate couldn't handle it, you know, that wouldn't have been good for his, he might have got fired, lost his pension and lost his government benefits. And, yeah, so it's you know, you see this whole confluence of events. And interestingly, again, you have the religious leaders and you have these pagan Gentiles both involved in it. Which is interesting because we as Gentiles, you know, after this, we come into the kingdom. The kingdom is not just Jew, it's Jew and Gentile. So here, Jew and Gentile take part in the execution, so to speak, which just kind of makes sense. It wasn't just the religious leaders. It wasn't just the Romans. And even though the Romans did the dirty work, so to speak, these religious leaders, I mean, you can imagine they're walking along that road and they're just taunting him and insulting him and say, oh, see, you say you're the Messiah, look at you. Pilate gives in. Okay, so read down to, down to 20 through 22.
So they took Jesus, and carrying the cross himself, he went out to what is called the place of the skull, in Hebrew, Golgotha. There they crucified him, and with him two others, one on either side, with Jesus in the middle. Pilate also had an inscription written and put on the cross. It read, Jesus the Nazarene, the King of the Jews. Now, many of the Jews read this inscription because the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city, and it was written in Hebrew, Latin, and Greek. So the chief priests of the Jews said to Pilate, do not write the King of the Jews, but that he said, I am the King of the Jews. Pilate answered, what I have written, I have written.
Okay, let's pause there. So they take him out to this place of execution. Now, this would be unclean, defiled place, because this is where they executed people. So it was blood, pieces of body everywhere. I mean, believe me, these weren't the only three people to be executed. I mean, this was kind of an ongoing thing. So this was an unclean place, and like you already read in Isaiah 53:12, you know, he's numbered among transgressors. You know, this is a place where criminals were killed. He's not a criminal. He's not, saying he's not a criminal doesn't even describe it. You know, if somebody did the least offenses of the law, you know, like you run a red light, you don't take him over there, crucify him. Or whatever the equivalent was. You didn't stop your chariot at the intersection or whatever it was. But this was a place where the most horrible criminals were killed. So Isaiah says he's numbered among the transgressors. Now, the Romans always put the charges against the guy. And always a man, because women were not crucified. Oh, just a man was crucified. But see, men were humiliated. Their clothes were taken off. It's always done in public. It's always done on the main street. You see here, it's the main street right by the cities. So everybody walks by. And they have the crime on top of the cross. So when these people walking around saw crosses, which they saw all the time, they were used to seeing he murdered. He killed a Roman soldier. You know, he rebelled against the, you know, he stole 50,000 shekels from the treasury or whatever it was. The crime was there. Pilate writes, it's King of the Jews. That's his crime as a king of the Jews. Now, technically, as somebody once said, since he died for our sin and every sin of the world was put on him, that inscription of the charges against him would be like an infinitely long piece of paper that had everybody's sin on it from Adam and Eve to whatever the last sin is, you know, because that's the charges against him. Now, interestingly, I didn't realize this till today when I was doing this. The Greek that's used in Matthew's gospel, it's called the accusation. Mark and Luke call it the inscription, and Matthew calls it the title. John calls it the title. That's interesting. And it's in the three languages that everybody kind of knew. I mean, everybody knew Hebrew. Now, it wasn't in Aramaic, which it probably should have been. Greek was kind of a language that educated people talked. Latin was the vulgar language that the soldiers talked and everybody, you know, common non-Jews talked. But they put it in all three languages so that there'd be no question what this was. So that was the crime. He's king of the Jews, which is kind of interesting. You know, Pilate finally works up enough spine to tell the leaders what's fun, to say, hey, just shut up. I wrote what I wrote, and that's it. But, you know, like 3-4 hours before this, he didn't have the guts to do anything. Yeah. Now all of a sudden he stands up to these guys. Well, a little late because he's already dead. So then we have this other amazing thing. Somebody want to start at 23.
When the soldiers had crucified Jesus, they took his clothes and divided them into 4 shares, a share for each soldier. They also took his tunic, but the tunic was seamless, woven in one piece from the top down. So they said to one another, "Let's not tear it, but cast lots for it to see whose it will be," in order that the passage of Scripture might be fulfilled that says, "They divided my garments among them, and for my vesture they cast lots." This is what the soldiers did.
Wow, so now that goes back to Psalm 22:18. "For my vesture they cast lots." You know, 1,000 years before it happened, then it's fulfilled at the cross. So they cast lots for his vestments. Okay, 25.
"Standing by the cross of Jesus were his mother and his mother's sister Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary of Magdala. When Jesus saw his mother and the disciple there whom he loved, he said to his mother, 'Woman, behold your son.' Then he said to the disciple, 'Behold your mother.' And from that hour, the disciple took her into his home."
Right. So John's the only apostle there, obviously. And I don't know, there's this confusing thing about these women. It sounds like Mary's sister is also named Mary. You know, yeah. I don't know, but that may mean somebody different. So his mother's sister, then there's a comma. So probably that means and Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. So all these people are named Mary that are staying there. But it's interesting to see that John's the only apostle that's there. Like, where are all those other guys? They all, like, took off. So he's the only one there. And this, of course, is, this fulfills Simeon's prophecy that a sword will pierce your heart, which was given, you know, 33 years ago now. Then some other psalms that are fulfilled there, because when we come to this next part, as I said, keep reading there at 28. Okay, now read 26 down.
After this, aware that everything was now finished in order that the scripture might be fulfilled, Jesus said, "I thirst." There was a vessel filled with common wine. So they put a sponge soaked in wine on a sprig of hyssop and put it to his mouth. When Jesus had taken the wine, he said, "It is finished." and bowing his head, he handed over his spirit.
Okay. So I just finished. So this is, you know, multiple levels of explanation of this. His life is finished. His work of salvation is finished. The Last Supper is finished because they only had 3 cups of wine instead of 4. Some people say this was the 4th cup of wine, the sour wine on a hyssop. We know hyssop is how you apply the blood of the lamb at Passover. So here hyssop is mentioned again. But he says it's finished, tetelestai. In the common Greek of the time, that can also mean, it can mean it's finished. It can mean, they used to write that on bills that were paid, you know, so you could prove you paid for something. They wrote tetelestai on it. So your bill was, you know,
paid in full.
Yeah, paid in full. And so he has to, if you read those Psalms, and you can read it for your homework, talks about how thirsty he is and his tongue's cleaving to his palate. And I mean, the dehydration would be, I mean, unimaginable. But the way David describes, you know, my tongue cleaves to my palate, you know, my tongue cleaves to the roof of my mouth. You know, David's writing it, but Jesus, it's about Jesus. Which again, it goes back to the prophetic, you know, fulfillment and stuff. 31.
Now, since it was preparation day, in order that the bodies might not remain on the cross on the Sabbath, for the Sabbath day of that week was a solemn one, the Jews asked Pilate that their legs be broken and that they be taken down. So the soldiers came and broke the legs of the first and then of the other who had been crucified with Jesus. But when they came to Jesus, they saw he was already dead. They did not break his legs, but one soldier thrust his lance into his side, and immediately blood and water flowed out. An eyewitness has testified, and his testimony is true. He knows that he is speaking the truth, so that you also may come to believe. For this happened so that the scripture passage might be fulfilled. Not a bone of it will be broken. And again, another passage says, they will look upon him who they pierced.
So, it's a preparation day. So it's Friday afternoon. It's April. So it's going to get dark at 6-ish. So the Sabbath is going to start at 6:30. So you have to get the bodies down from the cross. You can't have dead bodies laying around on a Sabbath. You can't leave bodies on the tree. Anybody who comes in contact with him then is immediately defiled. But this was such a special Sabbath. You know, in the Sabbath that falls during that week, the Feast of Unleavened Bread. But it's like the Sabbath between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur is called Shabbat Shuvah. That's a very important Sabbath. It's the Sabbath of repentance. So that's a very powerful Sabbath with all kind of extra things they do. A Sabbath that falls here immediately after Passover is huge. And then the way the calendar was that year, remember, it's a lunar calendar, so it's always different. It's not always the same date. So the following day that year, the next day, Sunday, was the Feast of First Fruits. So Jesus fulfills 3 of the 4 spring feasts within about 36 hours. Passover, Unleavened Bread, and First Fruits. So it's preparation day. It's a very important Sabbath. And so they break the legs because when you break somebody's legs who's on a cross and they immediately die because they can't push forward anymore. So they suffocate. The only way you live on a cross, and putting that foot piece on just prolongs the torture because you put your feet on there and then you can push forward. And as you push forward, you can breathe again. But then, you know, you're nailed or tied. After a while, you get tired, so you have to go back again. So once they break your legs, you can't do it anymore, and you die within a few minutes. So he was already dead. And so, of course, you can't break any of the bones. Exodus 12:46, Psalm 34:20, not a bone will be broken. You can't break the bone of the Passover lamb. David writes, not a single bone will be broken. So the soldier with the lance, you know, so that's physiologically, he would have had a pericardial effusion. There would have been mostly water at this point. So the lance went in, I forgot which intercostal space it went in, but when it punctured the pericardium, then all that pressure would have been released. Because, you know, the heart beats inside the pericardial sac, and imagine how fast your heart's beating if you're blood depleted, fluid depleted, and you're going through all this suffering, and then it just fills up with fluid. So that's what would have come out. So that's why it was blood and water. So that follows physiologically. And again, he says, I'm the eyewitness. And then Zechariah 12:10 is one of my favorite verses in the whole scripture, because it's actually been fulfilled once and it's going to be fulfilled again. Now, why are you? Yeah. So if you go to 12:10, I love this.
I will pour out on the house of David and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem a spirit of grace and petition, and they shall look on him whom they have thrust through, and they shall mourn for him as one mourns for an only son, and they shall grieve over him as one mourns grieves over the firstborn.
Okay, so what happens at the cross? They looked on someone they had pierced, right? So Zechariah 12:10 was partially fulfilled, but the second part of that was not fulfilled. There wasn't a spirit poured out on Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. They didn't look at him and say, oh, they didn't mourn like he mourned for an only son. Mm-hmm. He was an only son in terms of he's their own flesh and blood. But this is a future event. This is, you know, when Paul writes all Israel will be saved, something's going to happen suddenly where they're going to realize that he's the Messiah. He said, the Spirit's going to be poured out on Jerusalem. They're going to look on him whom they've pierced. Some translations say, look on me whom they have pierced. And they'll mourn like you mourn for an only son. Which means they're going to go, oh, I can't believe it. We missed it for 2,000 years. So it'll be fulfilled twice. Who could even stand it? I can't even deal with people who say the Old Testament's so boring. Can't even deal with it. Well, you know that already. Yeah, so that's pretty cool. Okay, so let's finish up with the burial, because this is good too. Anybody?
After this, Joseph of Arimathea, secretly a disciple of Jesus for fear of the Jews, asked Pilate if he could remove the body of Jesus, and Pilate permitted it. So he came and took his body. Nicodemus, the one who had just come to him at night, also came bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes, weighing about 100 pounds. They took the body of Jesus and bound it with burial cloths, along with the spices, according to the Jewish burial custom. Now, in the place where he had been crucified, there was a garden, and in the garden a new tomb in which no one had yet been buried. So they laid Jesus there because of the Jewish preparation day for the tomb.
Okay, so now we see, here's the body. Now, this is the body that has physically just died in order to conquer sin and to conquer death. You know, he conquers sin by shedding blood. He conquers death by rising from the dead. So he had to die in order to conquer death. So this is the body that had atoned for sin, was conquering death. Joseph of Arimathea had to go to Pilate and beg for the body. Like, is it okay?
He was a Sanhedrin.
And so he has to go and like beg Pilate for the body. And notice he's a secret disciple. He doesn't want to tell anybody. You know, it's kind of like us, you know, undercover believers. Undercover. You know, we don't want to tell anybody. Don't anybody think we're crazy. He's worried about his job. So, you know, he's a secret. And so you know, he's a secret disciple. Nicodemus, who's also, you know, he goes at night, so nobody sees him. Nobody knows what that he's talking to Jesus. But he brings myrrh and aloes. You know, myrrh is a spice of death and bitter, and aloes is fragrantly smelling. So there's bitter and fragrant. You know, it's bitter because there's this death. It's fragrant because this is our salvation, which is, it's pretty cool. Psalm 45:8 talks about that. But I figure this is, you know, in his case, we see the bitterness of death, but the fragrance of salvation. And, you know, he has to be buried quickly and without ceremony. Why? Because it's the Sabbath. But how ironic that the blood that brings us salvation, the body that conquers death, has to be quickly buried because, you know, there's no time to do any kind of ceremony or anything. And he's buried in a garden. Isn't that cool? Buried in a garden. Sin and death came in a garden, and then now sin and death are conquered in a garden. All salvation history is about two gardens and two trees. The first garden was a beautiful place, beautiful tree, and sin and death came. The second garden was a horrible, oppressive place. The second tree was a horrible instrument of death, and life came from that. So he buried in a garden, and it's an unused tomb. It's never been used. It's there, but not been used. So interestingly, look at Jesus is born of in a virgin's womb. And then he's buried in, quote, a virgin tomb that no one's ever been laid in. Remember, they didn't have, like, little individual plots of stuff. They got buried in caves. So no one had ever been in that tomb, just like no one had ridden the donkey at Palm Sunday. So he's basically in a virgin tomb, and this is what he arises from. So his physical life starts in a virgin womb, and he rises from a virgin tomb. And Isaiah talks about that in 53 too, saying, you know, a grave's assigned among evildoers, even though he hasn't done any evil. So how cool is that?